Welcome to the Better Questions Podcast, where we wrestle with hard questions and seek to ask better ones. This is the first episode of season two. Thank you for tuning in. I have an esteemed guest with me today to kick off a new season, my good friend and comrade, Connor Fritzy.
Connor, how's it going?
Let me try that again.
Oh.
I legitimately just totally had a brain fart. I wasn't even trying to be funny. I'd like to introduce my guest today, my good friend, Carter Fritzy. Carter, welcome to the pod.
Thank you. Happy to be here. Have limited time, though.
Limited time, so we got to be focused and on it. But before...
I have a lot of podcasts to be on today.
Carter is a podcast man.
Try to get on as many as I can. Yeah. 4 to 5 per pod. I got Jay Leno next, so...
I believe you, 100%. Carter, tell the people who are listening who you are, a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, let me give you some background. I have none.
That's true. Where were you born?
I was born in Wichita, Kansas, born and raised. Grew up going to Eastminster, coincidentally. 3 years, 2.5 years into the young adult world. So, yeah, faith background, grew up in the church, went to Eastminster, and have a lot of questions.
A lot of questions.
So many questions.
Hey, in fact, one of the reasons why I wanted you to come on the podcast is we were chatting in between services. We're just going to dive right in. Chatting in between services on church last Sunday, and you asked me a question that was a good question, and I thought, that was a better question.
Not sure you had a better one.
I think my entire peak list question. It is peak. Do you remember the question? I thought it'd be a good time. I was wishing we had a mic recording on Sunday.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you weren't wired.
Yeah.
So my question was, in terms of worship, I always say that my pet peeve is performance worship or the stage, you know, concert worship of I've got the fog machines, I've got lights, I got people going nuts on stage, hitting the Dougie or something, dancing, I don't know, doing crazy stuff.
Yeah, no, I know.
And I've always looked at that with a negative light, like, what is this for? Are we trying to manufacture an emotion? Mm-hmm. What's this all about? But then I see the other side too of, are we just trying to get more people in, enjoy the performance aspect of it? So I truly don't know, and that's why I asked.
Yeah.
So my pet peeve, and every church does this, most churches do this, is the outro
music
on the piano or the synth, and it's like band, come on up, and then the guy at the piano comes up, puts his and it's like, you know, start the closer. But that's always rubbed me the wrong way. But then I was thinking, do I have the right attitude? Should I be so negative about it? Sure. Or should, is there a positive spin?
Yeah, no, it's a really great question. And as a pastor, I know that outro music really makes the prayers pop at
Boost,
the end, right?
Yeah.
I think it's a good question. I think where I would push back is, if anything, because I think there's a lot of merit to... a lot of this boils down to the way in which we do church in the West. And by West, I mean North America, Australia, sort of that cultural expression in today's age. And I think one of the things that we often build our church services in a way that is attractional. And in some ways, to be critical, I think sometimes we can be focused on creating something to be consumed. So you'll hear people say, I'm going church shopping, right? I'm going to go, which is, when you think about that, it's like, that's weird.
Very consumeristic.
Right? It's like Christmas. You're going shopping for what best is something that you enjoy the most. Like if you're going to go to a restaurant, do you like the food? You know, you consume the food. Is it good? Are you going to go back? And it's almost like we treat a church that way. And so when you look at worship as a product, right? I was once at a leadership conference, and the speaker kept saying, we have a better product. And I thought to myself, wow, they really just doubled down on this idea that, like, people are coming to consume whatever it is they're bringing, whether it's good preaching, whether it's good music. But worship in and of itself has become, I think, in a lot of ways in North America, this sort of product, if you will. It's certain churches dress it up differently. And I don't think that's exclusive to contemporary style of worship, although I think that style of worship can maybe lean in a little bit because, you know, you have individual instruments. You have oftentimes really cool backgrounds on the screen. You've got, you said fog machines. We don't use fog machines, but there are churches who definitely do. You're trying to create, and from their perspective, I get it, because it's like they're trying to create an atmosphere for worship where people can, it's basically like trying to engage the senses, right? Mm. Sight, sound.
Smell.
Taste. But I do think that, like, I think there's a fair critique, especially when you're trying to get other, you're trying to bring other people into worship when they are distracted by, you know, the guitar solo on stage. They're distracted by just the sheer extravagance of what's going on. That can become a distraction. I think the pushback I would say to your question, or maybe the other question I would ask, is what is, as human beings, we are moved and stirred by music, right? So what is wrong with engaging the emotions in worship? And if music does that, if the outro to a worship service sort of draws up emotions in us, what is the problem with that, is what I would pose to you.
Mm. That's a great question. A better question.
I know.
And it's got me thinking. The role of emotion in spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
If I changed worship, I made a rule that there's no music, there's no lights, there's nothing. We go and stand in a room with white walls, and there's nothing in there. There's nothing for your emotions to take hold of. Is that some kind of pure form of worship? No.
Yeah.
But I don't know. It's a great question.
Yeah, and I think like it's a generational thing too, because you go to an older generation who grew up on hymns and just hymns and a hymn book, right? No music, no, maybe an organ, and that's it. There is certainly it's not, the music may not be as emotive, but for the person who grew up in that, to them, that might be stirring their emotions in a different way than, say, someone who maybe grew up in a contemporary setting where, you know, they're singing, I'm trying to think of a song. I don't know why I can't think of any.
Our God,
yes,
is an awesome God.
That one. We're leaving that in. That was great. but I do think people engage differently.
Yeah.
And I think that stirring our affection towards something, not something, but someone, towards God, is ultimately part of the goal of worship, right? It's a response to what God has done. We're worshiping God because of what he has done. So we're already responding. And I think that stirring our emotions can be a good thing. Now, I think there's a spectrum, right? There's a point to where we can become manipulative.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where, like, I would say the line, there's a line you can cross where, you know, at the end of a service, when emotions are high and the worship leader is saying things, and, you know, I think that people can be taken advantage of in those spaces, and there can be what I would call spiritual manipulation.
Mm.
And that's not what we want to do. But I think there is a difference between, you know, engaging the emotion and moving it towards God as opposed to a different means or different end.
I guess you have to go back to what's the point of worship?
Right.
Careful, I'm testing you. Where do you see in scripture, like, the oldest references to worship? What did that look like? What were people doing?
I mean, you go back to Exodus to see people singing. I mean, you have it all throughout the Psalms, and it says many of the Psalms have, it talks about David in the instruments with the lyre, or it talks about, you know, singing and dancing. The Psalms were often sung in community. This has been something that's been going on for a long time.
To be performed with.
Right.
Three-stringed.
Yeah.
So if we keep to the biblical, if we go to the old, I mean, we should have a lute up there and nothing else.
if that's how, you know, we want to interpret those things, that would be a very, you know, I think people might really vibe with that.
Excellent. I had, the only last thing I had to add was I went to a church in town, contemporary style.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing the pastor said kind of rubbed me the wrong way.
Mm.
And very, very much an outward, like,
yep.
You better have your hands raised. You better be, you know, getting really into it. And he got up on stage and said, hey, you know, this might just be me, but I believe if you, you know, if you have a heart for God and you're really worshiping, that you should be externally, you know, you should have your hands raised. You should be getting into it. And I immediately was like, well, I don't think that's true. Because, again, yeah, it all depends on the person. You can be, I think, of people who can be standing and completely stoic, but having a profound engagement with God and feeling his presence just as much as the person who's hitting the Dougie in the... In the aisles.
I would love to see you hit the ducky in the aisles. And like, there are different postures in the scriptures. The scriptures talk about people singing with hands raised, people lying prostrate in the presence of God, which just means, you know, flat on your stomach, like totally in awe of God. And the whole teaching on that is that our outward expression of our bodies is just a representation of what's going on inwardly. And so I think it can be easy in both ways. Like I hear people all the time be like, oh, the 9:30 service, they're so stiff, right? Ugh. Frozen chosen, just singing away, but they're not really worshiping. When the truth is, they're expressing worship in a different way, but the status of their heart isn't necessarily representative by how they're emoting. And then like I see people at 9:30 be critical of 11, and it's like, you know, it's all a show. It's all, so you're trying to show people how much you're worshiping by how high your hand is raised.
Mm-hmm.
And so like, I get it. Cause like there are a lot of worship leaders who will say things like, you know, this may be uncomfortable for you, but as an act of an outward expression of an inward worship, let us raise our hands. And it's making people maybe stretch out of their comfort zone, which I think for some people is a good thing. So I think there is a nuance to that conversation. Great question, Carter. I'm going to throw you some fastballs.
Yeah.
Because our buddy Shane sent these questions in right before I took a break. So shout out to Shane. There's a lot of these. So I'm just going to throw some of these out there and we can kind of have a little discussion about them.
Mm-hmm.
One of the questions is, would persecution be a good thing for the modern church? And now what I think he's... To clarify this question, I mean, I think he's speaking specifically to the church in North America, where, because there are places where the modern church is facing persecution, particularly in China, Turkey, and other places. But for us, do we think it'd be a good thing?
It's a great question.
I know.
I love that question. Yes and no. Well, first off, I think the church in the U.S. does experience persecution. It might look different, especially... Probably not as much so in the Midwest, but on the coasts, like the whole cultural pressure of Christianity being seen in a negative light. Like, I think that can, there's definitely some detriment to proclaiming your faith in certain areas of the country. But
sure.
To the main question, I think it can be good. Yeah. I don't want to wish persecution on the church, but I think I immediately think about the early church. I mean, in the very beginning, I mean, when Rome had not yet taken on Christianity, that Christians were being persecuted left and right, and yet the faith spread like wildfire. And it's almost like you've captured this dangerous truth that is, you finally found what's real, what's true, and it circumvents all. It surpasses all established governments, leaders. The whole rule of the world is flipped upside down. And when you have that truth and you know that, I mean, and you feel that pressure around you, I think it just spurs you on to spreading the gospel and spreading the word. But I don't know.
Right. There's something to... When a community is facing opposition, right? Something happens to that community. It's almost like, you know, when you're experiencing very little difficulty or a crisis, you're not being forced to grow. If you're not training your body to exercise and do things, like your body's, your muscles are going to, you know, slowly atrophy. And like, there's something about pressure and experience that can cause someone to grow. It was William Faulkner, one of the greatest American authors, said, "It's hard believing, but disaster seems to be good for people." Mm. Right? Or we go back to 1955. He was asked to explain the overwhelming wave of creative output in Japanese poetry and literature that came after Hiroshima. And it's amazing, like, that one of the greatest tragedies of in Japanese culture was obviously the nukes. Shout out to Oppenheimer.
Or not.
Didn't know that. Awkward. I still haven't seen the movie, so I don't really know. But the disaster that of Nagasaki and Hiroshima, like, obviously that's horrific. And it's always going to be something that's horrific. But now it's a part of who they are. And it's a part mm-hmm. of, I think, what in that created something beautiful. Beauty from ashes is something that I think you can point to in the midst of that. I even think about like COVID-19, like mm-hmm. obviously horrific. We would never wish that on anyone. Or if we don't want that to happen again, like bye bye. And yet
when people lost something that they took for granted,
right.
It's like, we can't, I mean, I'm no longer able to gather with.
Right. It's a major shift in perspective. And the gathering became so huge for the church. I think of before we shut everything down, we were almost cutting programs. That people don't want to do this anymore. They're sick of gathering too much. And all of a sudden it was like, oh no, people needed that. Mm. It was almost a total reorientation back to, we didn't realize what we had and how much we needed it. So I think that's an interesting thing. I want to be careful because it's like, I don't think persecution, we don't want to romanticize it either. I mean, it's really horrific. You go back to some of the persecution in the time of Nero and some of the stuff that was going on. It's horrific, right? People being fed to lions. And like, I think sometimes we can romanticize it in our minds, but the truth is, like, I wouldn't wish that on anyone. And I would actually pray that those places that face persecution would at some point be liberated from that. Mm-hmm. And yet, at the same time, I think it's fair to say that God can do a work through persecution. And sometimes he humbles nations, right? Mm-hmm. We see this all throughout the Old Testament, where God will humble a nation and force them to change because of their turning away. Great question, Shane.
Thank you, Shane.
Another question from Shane.
Yes.
At what point should we consider violence an option to stand for our beliefs? I'm referencing when Jesus told Peter to buy a sword, is what he said. What do you think?
Wow. I have no clue. Well, you know, I do have a rich... I didn't go to seminary, yeah. But... should start all my sentences with that.
Yeah.
That's a great question. Is there a better question?
I think we can get into Christian pacifism and the different views on that. And like, is there a time for violence? Is there a time to bring out the sword? People will proof text that all the time. Hmm. When like people talking about, you know, guns in America, they're like, well, Jesus said we should have a sword. And they use that as some sort of like battering ram verse. And I think that they're just, we need to look at, instead of taking a single passage out of context, it's important for us to look at the entirety of Jesus' ethics. Like, what is he teaching in the Sermon on the Mount?
Right.
What is he teaching about violence? What are the Ten Commandments? I mean, there's thou shalt not murder. This is a very specific thing that is not good for human flourishing, obviously. And I think that, Jesus was recognizing and specifically preparing the disciples for what was coming. And I think more than anything, what's going on there is he's saying, look, there's going to come a time when you are going to be facing the remnants of what's going to happen after I leave. And remember, at this time, he's mentioned multiple times to the disciples that the end is coming, that he is going to die, and they just don't listen to him. They're like, sure. they don't want to believe him. Hmm. And he's trying to get his point across, like, look, Peter, like, it's going to get bad. You don't get it, but it's going to get bad. And it isn't until the upper room discourse that they really understand what's going on. And so I don't think here what's going on is it's saying violence is actually, I don't think violence is ever an appropriate position to take when we consider the totality of the teachings of the scriptures. I think we can easily pick out a nonviolent ethic. One of the books that I recommend is Greg Boyd's book on, I'm going to blank on the name, Cross Vision, which takes a full picture of nonviolence through a cruciform theology. We don't have time to get into it, but it's a really, really good perspective if you want to read more on that issue. Let me ask you this question. Let me reframe it. Let's say you married. Are you married?
No.
Okay, let's say you get married.
Where's this going?
and you have kids, and someone breaks into your home.
Oh, classic.
The classic example. Right? What? And someone threatens to kill your family, and you have a gun because you're an American.
Yeah, I've got two on me right now.
what would you do in that situation? Is it ethical to defend your family in that situation?
Let me give a stab at it. This is what I think.
Yep.
I think someone breaks in my house. Man, I think if they come after us, like self-defense, I think, man, that's tough. I think so.
Yeah.
That's for fine. Self-defense. I'd give them a little warning, be like, please get out of my house. Probably wouldn't say please. Notice I do have a gun. But if he's just coming after us, that's a great question. I don't know.
Yeah. I think one of the things that like people will often say is, well, in that situation, we need to lean into the ethic of turn the other cheek. And I'm like, okay, first of all, does that mean if somebody shoots one of my children, I'm like, oh, shoot the other one? Like, it doesn't apply apples to apples in that situation. Mm-hmm. And even in the turning of the cheek illustration that Jesus uses as a metaphor, he's actually, there's more going on in that story, right? When someone would slap someone, right, they would slap with the right hand, right? You'd smack them across the cheek. By turning the other cheek, what you're saying to that person is slap me with your left hand, which means slap someone with the hand that you would use to, well, they didn't have toilet paper back yet, so you can kind of fill in the blanks, right? So it was actually a play, it was putting almost like a third way option. So it was nonviolence, right? Instead of slapping the person back, it's making the other person slap you in a place of shame, from a place of shame. And any person with dignity would be like, no, I'm not going to touch you with my left hand. So it was almost like a third way that was actually provocative, and it made the person who was attacking you think twice.
Mm.
So let me turn it back to the guy with the gun.
So after I've told him these things.
After he comes in.
After I've explained this situation. And he points
the gun. And I would say to them.
I'd say. I'm having a little bit of a ethical dilemma in my head right now.
Do you want to play a game? Which hand? And I put my hands out. He'd pick one, and I grab the gun, throw it. No, I think in that situation, I would absolutely try to defend my family. Now, could I do it without killing the person? That'd be the goal.
Right, yeah.
I'd shoot him in a place that maybe wouldn't kill him.
Mm.
But I don't know. It's a tough scenario that I wouldn't will on you.
Hopefully we're never in.
Or me. Great question, Shane. Dude, you have great questions. I'm going to ask one more and then we'll wrap it up. Oh, this is a beast of a question. I don't think we can tackle this.
No, we got it.
Okay. Although the Bible doesn't specifically mention certain things as sins or evil, from a biblical perspective, not a cultural one, what should our stance be on child brides, slavery, and things that were around in Bible times but taboo today?
Yeah, what was the other question?
This question.
Well, I guess the better question, I think, is how do you reconcile Old Testament practices of things that just today are not culturally and perhaps unacceptable.
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it, and even I had this question about polygamy.
Mm.
And one of the things, when we read biblical accounts, just because something is a historical account that we read about in the scripture does not indicate that God condones that kind of behavior, right? We read about rape. We read about polygamy. We read about murder. Just because we read about it in the scriptures that it happened or existed in the culture, it doesn't mean that that's God's best design or ethic for humanity.
Mm.
And so I think we just need to be careful. Like, yes, that may exist. Kids got married at the age of, 12, 13 in the biblical times. And a lot of that was arranged marriages. And sometimes it'd be a 13-year-old with a 25-year-old, right? In our mind, that's wrong. We have laws to protect against that. But in that time and place and space, marriage was much more transactional. It was much more about deeds and land, and parents made these decisions for their kids. So it's just a totally different cultural perspective. But it doesn't change the Christian ethic on marriage, sexuality, what we have defined both by Jesus himself as well as the creation account, and some of the stuff that Paul gives us, right? To submit to one another. We can go on and on about the teachings about biblical sexuality. I don't know. What thoughts do you have?
None. I'm going back, and it kind of makes me think, what, maybe there are instances that we've injected modern ideas into Christianity that
maybe aren't.
I don't think any of those apply to those listed, but I'm trying to think of any kind of example of some kind of modern day standard that we've injected into Christianity that may not be.
I think a good example of that is the elevation or idolatry of the nuclear family. I actually think that while I love my family of six and I would do anything for them, I think that in our church culture, we can elevate marriage and family to a place of unhealth where it becomes, the scriptures, talk about the beauty of singleness. Mm. And while that's, Paul's like, look, if you burn with passion, get married, but I'm single and I can do such incredible things for the kingdom. Right. Jesus says, you should hate your mother and father, which is a very strong thing to say. He's being hyperbolic, but the whole point is we should not idolize family to this elevated place. I don't think that the scriptures necessarily teach us to.
That's a great example. I mean, in Paul's writings, you're right. He makes it very clear.
Mm-hmm.
When you go through Paul's writings, it's almost like I can be single or I cannot, yep. Whatever God wants for me, I can serve his kingdom in either ways just as much.
Right. One of the questions that got submitted was like, can a single person be a pastor? And I'm like, yeah.
Oh, totally. But the cultural standard is,
right?
That's odd. That's a little bit suspicious. I mean, shouldn't you be?
Yeah, I know. I applied to be a youth pastor. I was 22 years old. And they said, we really liked you, but we want someone married.
Mm.
And I was like, okay. Right. Like, it just seems like a standard that is a cultural standard, not a biblical one.
Right. I think so. And there's also some good reasons for that. If you were to say, hey, you're pastoring to a congregation of a bunch of married people.
Right. Totally.
You'll be more effective if you, but there's always going to be that judgment.
Yeah.
Yeah, I always tell people, the most complete man who ever lived, Jesus was single. Paul, the greatest missionary of all time, mm-hmm. was single.
Carter.
Me? Single. The second greatest.
Hey, by the way, if you're listening, Carter Fritzy, single, ready to mingle.
That's actually why I'm on the podcast. This is an advertisement.
Just send in your information to Better Questions, and I'll send it over to Carter.
Thank you. Yeah.
The only one thing I'll touch on there is the slavery thing, and that's a really big can of worms open. We don't have to dive into it too deep, but it's interesting when people make that claim that, like, you know, the Bible condones slavery or makes it okay, and they had slaves, and I really like cringe at that, largely because the entire Old Testament is all about liberation from slavery. Like God's heart is for Israel to be liberated from slavery. Remember back when you were slaves and you were liberated. And then even you look in the New Testament, the book of Philemon, you've got this example of, you know, this, hey, look, you need to be treating your slave, not slave at the time, it was a bondservant, with dignity, right, and honor. And it goes back to the mistreatment of that relationship. And it's hard to go apples to apples from what slavery looked like in the New Testament versus what it looked like for a lot of our country's history. It's way different. But at the same time, a lot of the ethics and principles are the same. That's a long conversation, but
it is.
I wanted to make sure I hit that for Shane. Anything else?
Shane, if you're out there.
Yeah, she's an avid listener, so I'm sure he is.
No, I think that's it. I think, you know.
Yeah. Carter, you got anything to plug?
Yes.
Okay.
So I'm starting a pickleball group. We have one going. Ooh. With the Eastminster Young Adults.
Yeah.
So if you're a pickler, if you play pickleball, just know that there are dozens of us out there as well.
Where do you play?
Edgemoor Park.
Edgemoor Park.
Saturdays, Eastminster Young Adults. We're out there in 100 degrees. We'll be out there in 0 degrees. But it's been a little bit concerning how much I've told people about that. I go to work and I go, yeah, just play pickleball. I love it.
I can't wait. I am going to join. It's soccer season, so it makes it a little tough right now.
Right.
But great, man. Thanks for coming on.
Hey, no problem.
It's been great.
It's been so good.
Hey, thanks for tuning in. Send in your questions, betterquestions@eastminster.org. We've got more episodes coming. It's going to be a great year. Grace and peace.